Anna Petoniak grew up in British Columbia and now lives in New York City. She wrote both of her novels in what she euphemistically calls her spare time while holding a full-time job as a senior editor at Random House. Her first novel, The Futures, received strong reviews in Harper's Bazaar, Cosmopolitan, The Village Voice, and other publications. Today, she will talk to us about her second and new book, Necessary People, which has already been named a best book by Cosmopolitan, Town and Country, and Crime Reads. The June 3rd issue of People magazine, that is as in 4 days ago, the June 3rd issue of People magazine selected Necessary People as its book of the week. Here is what the critic Kim Hubbard had to say about the novel, and I quote, Petoniak delivers a pitch-perfect exploration of class, family, and female friendship, along with a gripping peek inside the inner workings of the TV news business. I can't wait. Join me in welcoming Anna Petoniak.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you, Peter, for that wonderful introduction. This is such a beautiful building, and I recently became a member of the New York Society Library, which is a sort of equivalent organization in New York. So a space like this feels very much like home, so conducive to good books and good writing. I'm excited to talk to you about Necessary People. I'm going to start with a short excerpt from the beginning. The narrator is a smart, ambitious young woman named Violet Trapp. Violet grew up poor. Her best friend is the beautiful and wealthy Stella Bradley, who represents everything Violet doesn't have. So here they are. As luck would have it, Stella and I were in the same dorm. Within a week, Stella decided that she disliked her assigned roommate. Within a week and a half, the school happily accommodating given her parents' donations, I'd switched places with this girl, taking her bed while she took mine. Stella told people that her old roommate had sleep apnea and the machine kept her up at night. The truth, which she told me alone, was that she found this girl pious and mousy. Got it, I remember thinking, avoid those things. When I passed this mousy girl in the dining hall or library, I gave her a sympathetic smile. I felt sorry for this girl, but I wouldn't have changed a thing. My position came with advantages. Stella had treated it as a fait accompli that I'd come home with her for Thanksgiving. I hadn't even considered going back to Florida, and Stella didn't question that, which was another reason to love her. Thank God we saved you from those people, she sometimes said, which was the closest we ever got to talking about my family. My home seemed to exist in her mind as a dense jungle, a tangle of sinister mysteries. I loved the calm and comfort of the Bradley family. But what I couldn't admit to Stella, what I could barely admit to myself, was the underlying calculation. It whirred constantly in the back of my mind. To wind up at a private college like this was luck enough, but to wind up best friends with the most dazzling girl on campus? It wasn't that my personality changed when I met Stella. It was that it became, it flourished, because I could say things to Stella that I wouldn't have said to anyone back home, knowing they would only respond with bafflement or laughter. And she always volleyed right back, sharpening me like a whetstone to a knife. I didn't just want the friendship of this dazzling girl. I wanted the world that had made her so dazzling in the first place. This was a golden opportunity not to be taken for granted. So I paid attention. I studied everything. I learned the vocabulary and the syntax. It was hard work to win over people like the Bradleys. But in the service of a larger ambition, hard work is nothing. Besides, genetics dictated that I'd inherited the streak of darkness in my parents. Overcoming that would take deliberate effort. I'd rip the weeds out by the root, leave the soil rich and bare. I was certain that if I played the game correctly, I could become someone better. The past could be overcome. Outcomes could be changed. And through the years, new things grew. My role became firmly established. Violet's the responsible one, Stella told people, slinging her arm around my shoulder, spilling her drink in the process, and I'm a mess. Everyone came to agree on this. Stella Bradley didn't care about anything. That's what made her so fun. Stella's credit card paid for spontaneous road trips, lavish meals, and hotel rooms. She made cutting remarks about her family's net worth as she handed over the platinum Amex. She liked being rich, but she knew that it wasn't really her money, so she expurgated her guilt with fits of generosity. The fun we had was genuine and real, but Stella was also strategic when she declared me to be the responsible one. My responsibility had a particular utility. Stella had a unique tendency to get herself into binds. I got her out of them. I retrieved her when she was stranded, brought her money when she'd forgotten her wallet, held her hair back when she vomited from drinking too much. I saved her over and over. "See," she'd say when I rescued her from yet another scrape, "see how right I am?" There was an assumption, shared by nearly every student at our expensive college, that anything was possible. No careers, no avenues were off limits. Your ambition didn't have to be circumscribed or compromised. Stella had taught me how to live in this world of long horizons. I imagined the years ahead, the two of us gradually becoming equals. Look at how well the system had taken care of the Bradleys. If I worked hard, wouldn't it take care of me? But that, I eventually realized, was naive. Stella opened doors for me. She showed me how confident and outspoken a person could be, even a young woman whom the world is not inclined to take seriously. I learned by watching her, witnessing the power of her charm and confidence. I loved Stella, and beyond that, I needed her. This life wouldn't have been possible without her. But the things you need when you're 19 years old aren't the things you need later. People change. Relationships change. There would be a test in the years to come. Could I do it without her? Or, more accurately, could I do it in spite of her? So that is chapter one of Necessary People. The most common question a writer tends to get is, where do you get your ideas from? So that's where I'll begin. I'll walk you through what it looks like when the idea arrives, how it develops from there, and then talk more broadly about some of the themes in this book. I'm now a full-time fiction writer, but as Peter mentioned, this is a recent change. After college, I went to work in book publishing, where I spent many years, and up until last fall, I was a senior editor at Random House. It was while at Random House that I first got the idea for what would become Necessary People. Random House published an author who was a well-known TV personality. When his new book came out, his boss at the TV network threw a book party for him. It was quite intimate, maybe half the size of this room, not many people there, and there were only a few of us there from Random House. Everyone else in the room was a TV person. And I'll admit, I was a little starstruck, because these were people who I saw day after day on the morning shows or on the evening news. And in the moment, I was aware of a strange duality. I felt like I knew these people, but of course, I didn't know them at all. And watching them talk in the room like any group of colleagues would, trading water cooler gossip or griping about their day, reminded me that they were real flesh and blood people, much more complex and multidimensional than you would ever see on screen. Nothing actually happened at the party. It was a very normal evening, my being starstruck aside. But sometimes it's those ordinary moments that lodge in your mind and start to alter your consciousness. As I walked home from the party that night, I thought about the dynamic I'd just experienced. What's it like when the world only sees one part of a person, but the real person is much more complicated? Or, to flip that, what's it like when you know a person in her totality, but the rest of the world can't see what you see? This is especially pertinent to something like TV news, and the TV world is where I chose to anchor this novel. But it's also true on a universal level. It's true in romantic relationships, and it's true in friendships. When we love a person, we know them better than anyone else in the world does, which means we see the good parts and the bad parts. So, with this seed of an idea churning in my mind, what comes next? Other than where do you get your ideas, it seems like the next most common question for a writer is, do you always know what's going to happen? In other words, are you an outliner, or do you just make it up as you go along? I'm sort of in between. When I had this idea, I knew that I wanted to write about two young women, Violet and Stella, best friends who are also polar opposites and extremely competitive. I had an immediate sense of where I wanted the story to end up, but I didn't know how I was going to get from point A to point Z. A lot of this is because at the start of the writing process, I don't have a perfectly clear idea of who these characters are. I can only see them from afar. It's like if you spotted someone across the room at a party, and you could infer certain things about her based on her body language or the way her voice carries, and maybe you've heard a few things about her through the grapevine. But in order to get to know her, you have to spend time with her. My goal is to create characters who feel real and believable. I also want their actions to feel real and believable. This is why outlining ahead of time doesn't work for me. I can't imagine how a character will behave in a given situation unless I know them really, really well. And getting to know them requires spending a lot of time with them. So I begin by writing a very rough first draft. In this draft, I'm working out certain parts of the plot, but more to the point, I'm just spending a lot of time with these characters. I'm learning how they think, how they speak, how they interact. At some point toward the end of that draft, I'll finally understand on a deeper level what this story is about and who these people are. It feels like something snapping into focus, like, oh, that's what motivates Violet. That's when I have to set the first draft aside and begin fresh with a brand new second draft. This is where the book actually starts to look like the book, because I finally know what's going to happen, and I can write the story in a way that's hopefully coherent and interesting. But let me pause and talk about what happens on a parallel track, which is the research. From the outset, I knew that I wanted to set this story in the world of TV news. But I've never worked in TV, and I didn't know much about the world. I began by reading as much as I could. There are a lot of great behind-the-scenes accounts about this world. Brian Stelter wrote a book about the drama at the Today Show. Gabe Sherman wrote a book about Fox News. Sheila Weller wrote a book about powerful female anchors. There are memoirs by numerous TV personalities. There are movies like Broadcast News and Network, and I inhaled all of that. But the most helpful thing was talking to people who had actually worked in that world. I especially wanted to know what it was like to work your way up from the bottom of the ladder, from the very lowest rung. What's it like on day one when you walk into a place like CNN or NBC? What's the work that you're immediately asked to do? I interviewed a number of people who worked in that world, and they gave me a great sense of texture, the daily rhythms, the lingo, the interactions between producers and talent, and so on. I was doing this research simultaneous with writing the first draft. So that whole first draft process on every level is about working out my understanding who the characters are, and understanding what the world is. I found that I can't reach that understanding except by writing. I have to work out my ideas on the page as I type. And certain themes start to emerge during this process too. One theme really struck me when I interviewed those TV producers. I found that when you talk to people about their work, it's rare that they're absolutely passionate about what they do. Plenty of people are passionate, of course, and if you have that passion, you're lucky. But most of the time during my daily life in New York City, most of the people I meet have mixed feelings about what they do. Not so with these TV producers. It was fascinating to sit across the table from them and see the fire burning in their eyes. These people knew that their work was important, that it was pivotal. They believed in their work with absolute certainty. They believed that a free press is vital, that our democracy wouldn't work without them holding the powerful to account and bringing truth to light. And they're willing to make a lot of sacrifices in the name of that mission. One of the producers I interviewed told me a story that illustrates this. She worked with a young man whose job as a production assistant involved running scripts from the newsroom to the anchor in the studio. And I mean literally running. One day, mid-run, he tripped over a cable on the floor of the studio and fell hard. He was sprawled out on the floor with a broken leg. But the commercial break was ending. So for the next several minutes, he didn't get up, he didn't cry out, because if he moved, it would ruin the shot. So he stayed there with his broken leg until the segment was over. which is a little crazy, right? But people do these things because they're ambitious. They work brutally long hours, not just because they believe in the mission, but because they themselves want to succeed. This fusion of important work plus personal ambition became very interesting to me. If you frame your ambition in terms of a noble or higher purpose, you can use that purpose to justify certain things. That became a theme I wanted to dig into in this book. This is one reason I like to set my novels in worlds that are slightly different from the one that I already know. One of the key storylines in my first book, The Futures, was rooted in the world of finance. Necessary People is rooted in the world of TV news. And as I begin work on a third novel, I'm rooting it in yet another world. By immersing myself in that research and that lingo and those systems of belief, I find that interesting new themes and ideas come to the fore, much more than they would if I was writing about what I already know. For me, the learning is an important part of the creative process. Another reason is that it's also helpful when it comes to making the novel feel real. I think of it as a kind of scaffolding. Even when concocting these characters and stories from scratch, there are certain external structures that help me imagine the circumstances around them. It's also a way of getting closer to the characters. If my narrator, Violet Trapp, is a producer at a cable news station, I'm going to understand her a whole lot better if I know what it's like to work in cable news. So by the time I'm getting deep into a novel, I like to think that I have a good sense of who a character is. At the same time, they're becoming distinct individuals. The character is not me. Violet and Stella are doing things that I would never do myself. This is the great thing about writing fiction. It's a way of exploring scenarios and questions that might not come up in your own ordinary life. And in this book, compared to my first book, I wanted to push myself to a darker and riskier place. The result was an increasing divergence between what I would do in a given situation versus what my characters would do. And here was the challenge. Even with this divergence, I had to be able to understand why they were doing what they were doing. What was the psychological underpinning of each decision they made? What was their rationale to themselves or to other people? Because Violet and Stella both do bad things. They play dirty, they're ruthless. This leads to another question that writers often face. Why do you make your characters so unlikable? I want to pause on this point. I don't disagree that Violet and Stella can be unlikable at times, but I would maintain that all of us can be unlikable at times. All of us have our bad days. We're grumpy or self-centered or impatient. We get road rage. We snap at loved ones. I've never met anyone who is perfectly likable 100% of the time. For me, the primary goal is to write realistic characters. This means they have to be unlikable in some way. So Violet and Stella both do bad things. But if I've done my job well, if I've dug deep enough into their inner landscape, then I've shown you a possible reason why. I want you to be able to understand why they've done what they've done, even if you would have behaved differently, because honestly, so would I. When it's done right, this is the power of fiction. We walk around living inside our own heads, and this is all we ever know. Even though we can grow very close to another person and spend our whole lives with them, we can never actually get inside of their minds and know what's in their head. But fiction gives us that opportunity. For a little while, we can actually step into another person's life. We can see the world through their eyes, even if they aren't real. And this is incredibly powerful. I'd like to give you an example of what I mean by this. So last year, I read The House of Mirth by Edith Wharton. I'm sure a lot of you have read it too. And if you haven't, you should, because it is so good. I ate it up like it was an ice cream sundae. Lily Bart is the central character in that novel. She's a beautiful young woman. But if there was ever an unlikable person in fiction, Lily is it. She's a social climber. In addition to everything I just said, she's vain, shallow, and self-absorbed. She uses people like stepping stones. She does hurtful things. If you spotted a woman like her across the room, you might be inclined to steer clear. You might just write her off and decide not to waste your time with this ridiculous person. But as you read The House of Mirth, you have the chance to peer deeper into Lily's inner self. You see that beneath the venality and the vanity, there's an unresolved pain. Lily Bart, as beautiful and privileged as she is unable to believe in her own value and integrity. She relies on outward societal trappings to feel important and worthy. She's desperate not to lose those trappings. This is why she's such a strident social climber. And so her unlikability springs from a deep unhappiness. You meet people every day like Lily Bart, a person who is vain, shallow, self-absorbed, self-destructive, unlikable in any number of ways. Perhaps you're tempted to write off this person, as you might have written off Lily Bart. But when you remember The House of Mirth, you remember that there's more to it. This self-absorbed, unlikable person has a more complicated story. A novel like The House of Mirth allows you to exist inside another person's consciousness for a while. It allows you to understand why a person might behave that way. It's easy to feel empathy for people who are kind and lovely. The challenge is feeling empathy for people who aren't, because both groups of people are equally deserving of empathy. I think about Lily Bart a lot. Would I want to be her friend? Probably no. But it's those very qualities that make her such an important and illuminating fictional character. The unlikable characters are the ones who help expand our understanding of what the human heart is capable of. And we all need that understanding. And on a lighter note, I'd also add this. Sometimes it's the unlikable characters who have the most fun. They're breaking the rules, or they're playing by a different set of rules. They're getting away with things that we would never dream of. I know that I'd never do what Violet and Stella do in this book, but a little part of me can't help but admire them for it. So now, to close it out, and I'll be taking questions after this, so I hope you have some, I'll read a short passage from later in the book. At this point, Violet has been working at KCN, a cable news channel, for a few years. She's been making a good name for herself. The problem is, Stella's now working as an intern at KCN, too. That year, after dozens of shoddy pitches that gradually got stronger, my first story aired. The business beat had become my domain at Frontline because it played to my strengths. I could spend hours combing through documents and financial statements, invigorated rather than bored by the dry facts at hand. When the story aired, I felt relieved. I could really do this after all. The next morning, Stella was in the kitchen, already showered and dressed and drinking a mug of coffee. The night before, when our group went to the bar and toasted me, I'd been giddy with success, and Stella had been in a bad mood, sulking over her vodka soda. Now she held a yellow highlighter, which she ran over an article in the Wall Street Journal. Scattered across the counter were copies of the New York Times, the New York Post, and the FT. "You're up early," I said. Pouring myself coffee, I thought, Stella knows how to use the coffee machine? What are you doing? Is this for work? Stella nodded, staring at the paper. It seemed like an affect picked up from an old movie, this ink and paper highlighting in an age when everyone read the news online. "I don't get it," I said. "Is this an assignment?" She looked up, annoyed. "Do you not think I'm capable of taking initiative?" I held up my hands. "Sorry, I was just curious." I'm trying to get better at this, she sighed, capping the highlighter. It's like everyone just knows everything. In a meeting the other day, someone said, what was it? A tax holiday. And everyone in the room was like, oh yes, of course, a tax holiday. What the hell does that even mean? Where do you learn this stuff? She seemed genuinely irritated, which irritated me in turn. What I wanted to say was, you learn this stuff by paying attention, Stella. You pay attention because you have to pay attention. The world isn't going to unfurl itself for you. You have to pry it open. I wanted to say, a tax holiday is a simple concept. The meaning is encoded in the phrase itself, and your ignorance is your own fault. Instead, I smiled and said, don't worry, you'll pick it up over time. Stella's initiative wouldn't last. I was certain of that. It was a reaction to that brief moment when everyone was looking at me, not her. Her earnest newspaper reading, the newly alert way she answered the phone, the speediness with which she ran scripts to the control room. It was a performance for my benefit, wasn't it? Sometimes our relationship felt like one long game in which we were constantly keeping score. This was just another way for Stella to rack up a few points. She could be the eager-to-please intern that I had once been, too. But I was wrong. Stella was putting on a performance, but it wasn't for me. The story of our friendship was always the story of opposites, yin and yang in every regard. The pretty one and the plain one, the rich girl and the poor girl, the social butterfly and the bookish nerd. For every possible measurement, we stood at far ends of the spectrum. And there was one particular metric that clocked a vast gulf between us: ambition. Every decision I made was designed to distance me from my origins. Stella, on the other hand, always knew that she belonged. When you already have everything you could ever want, what good is ambition? Stella never had to think about how to dress, what to say, where to put her hands, whether to laugh or smile, whether to act smart or play dumb. It came naturally, like breathing. It was like that famous line, a fish asked how the water is, responds, this is water? That was life to Stella, a medium one could move through without even considering what the medium was or how that medium might feel to other people. Until, that is, she got to KCN. This is life? I could see the dismay on Stella's face during her early months of work. This is life? This uncontainable and roiling thing, chock full of complicated ideas and obscure terms? Conflict, avarice, war, incompetence. When you paid enough attention, life had a way of showing its ugly chaos. For the first time, Stella didn't understand what she was supposed to do. And now what did Stella want? She wanted the thing that she had once possessed, which had been wrenched away from her, that sweet, velvety sense of belonging. The rich girl and the poor girl, the pretty girl and the plain girl. If we were characters in a story, Stella was the one you always wanted to be. The girl who is quick to laugh, good at making friends, charming to strangers, comfortable in her own skin. The girl whose beauty is equated with virtue. Her heart open and capacious, not curdled by desperate ambition. Real trust, a coworker once said, can't be transactional. And what is ambition if not a constant transaction? Hard work, days, weeks, months of it, in exchange for more money, more power, more influence. I wanted to succeed, and that was my problem. People could see that desire. They could smell it. How can you trust someone who reeks of ambition? Stella's newly polished performance at KCN worked. The bosses noticed. It all happened within the span of a few weeks. She was promoted to assistant. She was invited to more meetings. People trusted her. Why? They knew that she was rich, that she didn't need this job. So she was doing it out of pure love for the work. Wasn't that admirable? I'd had more than a year's head start on Stella. But by that summer, she was closing the gap between us, and her shadow was looming over me again. That? So I'd love to take any questions if anyone hasn't. Yeah, so just to repeat the question in case anyone didn't hear, it's, you know, when you approach the writing of a book, are you taking into account the feeling dimension as well as the sort of thinking, intellectual dimension? The answer is yes, I always strive for that. But I think it's a thing that you have to be consciously working towards when you're writing a novel. And every writer is different. For some writers, that kind of emotional dimension might come intuitively. And I certainly saw that as an editor, where certain writers could channel an emotional feeling on the page just beautifully, and it was effortless for them in a way. But they struggled with dialogue or pacing or plot. For other writers, it was totally different. So everyone has their kind of innate strengths and weaknesses. I do think you're right that the reason books often sell so well is because they connect emotionally with a reader. I would say for myself, it's something I strive for. It's something I could certainly get better at, and I hope to continue, you know, evolving that over the course of my career. But it is interesting because to write a good novel, you have to use every part of your brain, not just the kind of intellectual abstract part, but the more gut level feeling part. Mm-hmm. The question is, you know, coming up with a name for Stella. So it was interesting for this book compared to my first book. I was more deliberate in choosing the names of the characters. With the first book, the names just kind of came to me and they felt right and I didn't overthink it. With this book, especially for the character of Stella Bradley, I was thinking about how, you know, when you have certain like TV anchors and you think, God, they have a name that was like born to be a TV anchor name, or like an NPR announcer, like Audie Cornish, like she has to be an NPR announcer. And I wanted there to be that kind of sibilant quality to Stella's name, like it rolls off the tongue. So you could imagine her being like, live from Channel 5, it's Stella Bradley. Like it sounds like that. So that's kind of honestly how I like came up with, I wanted it to sound a certain way. And then for Violet, because as you can probably tell from the reading, she's sort of a spiky character, she's got an edge. I wanted her name to sound like that. So then like the name Violet paired with the name Trap, it has like a hard-edged quality. So I was more deliberate in choosing the names for those reasons. I did not know her. This is a question from my my aunt Mary Jean. She's got the family lore. Yeah. Was there a question? It was my Aunt Mary Jean was just suggesting that perhaps Stella was named after a relative in my family who was a piece of work. But I never knew, I don't think I ever knew her. Did I? No, okay. I didn't know her. Yes.
And same thing of men?
Yes, very much so. It was actually a deliberate decision to make this book very female-centric, because my first book, The Futures, was about a young couple, a man and a woman. And that was very much the focal point of the story, was their romantic relationship. They're falling in love, they're falling out of love, and it was told from both of their perspectives. So Evan, you know, has half of the novel for that first book. And for this novel, I thought, I don't want to write about a romantic couple. I want to focus on a completely different kind of dynamic. So I purposely chose female friendship as a departure from that first novel. And I also particularly wanted to write about female workplace dynamics. And the reason that, you know, when you read this novel, as you correctly observed, sort of every central player in the story is a woman, it was a little bit of wish fulfillment, because I thought, how cool would it be for some, you know, big New York media company to just be stacked with these powerful women. And they're not all good women, like some of them are doing bad things, but I wanted to kind of use the vehicle of fiction to explore what all of those dynamics would be, top to bottom. Yeah, so this was a question or kind of an observation too about how the feeling of when you're watching someone on TV, you only know one part of them, and the real person is much more complicated, how that's more true than ever in this social media age we live in, which I totally agree with. I did kind of purposely stay away from writing about social media in this book because if you'll notice, like, the novel doesn't take place in any particular time. There's no, like, specific year it's associated with. Part of this was because I began writing this book, or I first got the idea for this book in 2015, and then, you know, was working on something else for a bit, was finishing my first book, and gradually came to it. And, of course, between 2015 and now, a whole lot has happened in the country. And I purposely did not want to be writing about cable news in the Trump era, because then that becomes like the black hole in which everything is sucked. So I kind of left that, you know, I didn't want to get into like the dynamics of Twitter or this or that. I sort of just like let that float away. But I do think it's really interesting, and especially in light of, you know, cable news and Hollywood actors and actresses. Another thing that happened in the course of my writing this book was the Me Too movement. And of course, we saw how many, you know, revered TV figures actually have these very sordid personal lives, whether it's Matt Lauer or Charlie Rose or others. And I do think that, you know, that kind of Jekyll and Hyde quality can be manifested in many different ways. Sometimes it, you know, as we saw in that movement, there's a lot of kind of sexual misconduct that winds up happening. And I do think that we're becoming more aware of that as a society, hopefully, that the way someone behaves in public can be very different from how they behave in private. Is there a writer I especially admire? Yes, there are many. I can go on for a long time. Speaking of Edith Wharton, who I mentioned in my presentation, I had never read her until a couple years ago, and I completely fell in love with her. I don't think there's anyone more astute about observing social dynamics in America, and it's incredible how fresh her books feel even when you read them today. So she's sort of a new favorite, even though, you know, she's been around for a very long time. But I would say another writer who I just adore is Donna Tartt. I love her novels, The Secret History, The Goldfinch. I even liked The Little Friend, which a lot of people didn't like, but I thought it was okay. She's such a fabulous writer. She just has that beautiful prose, immersive storytelling, characters who are like realer than life. So that's what I love about her. Yes. So it wasn't based on a particular real place, but kind of just a vague. It was more aesthetic than anything else. Like I have spent plenty of time on like beautiful liberal arts college campuses in the kind of New England or New York area. My parents both went to school in Massachusetts. We have a lot of Smithies in my family. But I kind of purposely had this be like a fictional made-up college because it's not that pivotal to the plot. And, you know, it doesn't come out in the best light because Stella Bradley's parents can just throw their money around and do whatever they want. There was no college that I thought of where I'm like, oh, that place sucks. I want to, like, say something bad about them in my novel. So I just thought, you know, I'm gonna kind of have these beautiful, small college campus aesthetics in my mind, and then just have this be not a real place. What was the word? Brutal. You know, I was pretty lucky. She's, even when she's brutal, she does it so nicely that, like, you can't even tell she's being brutal. She's very, very smart about how she edits a novel, which is kind of leading you gently towards a certain suggestion rather than, you know, chopping something to pieces. So she wasn't very heavy-handed in terms of like marking up individual sentences, but she definitely pushed me to develop certain characters, especially the kind of secondary characters. I found that I had spent so much time thinking about Violet and Stella that I maybe gave short shrift to the other people in the novel and had just kind of, you know, almost had them there as like placeholders. And my editor really pushed me. She's like, you need to make more of this character or that character. Yeah. What was the process in deciding who the narrator was going to be? It's a good question. I, again, speaking about making a deliberate change as compared to my first book was narrated from two points of view, two halves of this young couple. And I really wanted the second book to just be narrated from one person's point of view, sort of for a feeling of unity of voice, like you're just driving through this world and only seeing it through her eyes. And I always knew it was going to be Violet because she's the, you know, she's sort of the quiet, watchful one at the beginning of the story, and then she changes and things happen. But the book is about Violet's own development as much as it's about their friendship. So I really saw her as taking up more space in my imagination. So I knew that I wanted it to be her telling the story. Thank you.